Support for The Trend on WNIN comes from members of the Local Programming Fund. I'm Micah Schweitzer. As the Indiana General Assembly prepares for its 2013 session, an annual tradition takes place this weekend, the Hoosier Environmental Council's Greening of the State House. And we're joined today by HEC Executive Director Jesse Carbonda. He's on the phone from his office in Indianapolis. Welcome to The Trend.
Hi, Micah. Great to be with you.
The Greening of the State House keynote address is on the subject of climate change. So does that say something about what you think is central to this upcoming legislative session?
Well, our aim is twofold with our annual Greening the State House event. One is to spotlight a key environmental issue that's facing the state that we think is something that will take several years to address. And then the second motivation of Greening the State House is to educate people on issues that we see as pressing or potentially movable in the 2013 legislative session.
So climate change falls under the really long-range goal.
Exactly. And I think the backdrop is very appropriate. As you may know, all counties in Indiana were declared disaster areas this year, largely due to this unprecedented drought we've had. And we think that that backdrop, coupled with the fact that you've had some of the biggest drinking water reservoirs in Indiana suffer in terms of their water levels, seems like a very localized basis for thinking about what kind of change that climate change can cause in Indiana. We can't necessarily attribute those phenomena to climate change, but they're certainly consistent with climate change.
And we certainly seem to talk about it more when the weather gets wacky. I mean, Superstorm Sandy happens and suddenly we're all talking about climate change. Is that what it takes for our awareness to increase, even if, as you say, we can't necessarily make a direct correlation between the two?
I think so, and I think it's because of the tangibility of these impacts and because these various different types of climate change models all predict increasing intensity of storms, increasingly erratic rainfall patterns, increasing levels of drought. And so I think the more we see it, the more we're going to have to grapple with what the world could be like in the coming years.
There's a petition online right now for a climate action plan for Indiana, or for Indiana to adopt a climate action plan, climate change action plan. We don't currently have one.
That's right. You know, and we obviously are very motivated as an environmental group by the environmental merits of dealing proactively with climate change and the way it will impact water levels, in the way in which will impact, you know, the kind of species that survive and thrive in Indiana. But the other lens that we're looking at the climate change issue is in terms of the way it impacts the economy. You know, going back to the example I brought up earlier in the segment, you know, we're seeing real strain on crop yields. We're seeing the increasing prospects of greater and lengthier droughts. And those things hurt our economy. They hurt our recreational sector. And so the adoption of a climate plan is necessary, not just from an environmental perspective, but an economic one. It's an economic and a moral obligation for the state to think ahead and plan ahead and figure out how we can head off the damage that will be caused by climate change on balance.
And I imagine as you work with legislators, if they are at all representative of the groups they represent, the people they represent, you're going to have a wide variety of viewpoints and understanding of the issues and different degrees of knowledge. How do you reach common ground with people who may have very different views from the ones you're trying to bring and promote?
Well, I think the first thing is to go in there with the sense that this is a steady effort at relationship building, and we're not going to be able to win over a legislator to our position within 5 or 10 minutes of spending time with them. We've got to invest in a relationship of mutual trust building and to become aware of what the core concerns on the part of those legislators are and try to see if there's a meeting of the minds in terms of the policies that we're pushing for and how they might resonate with those core concerns. One thing that we do in general in terms of the legislative proposals that we bring forth to the General Assembly is to focus on things that we emphatically believe will improve both the economy and the environment. You know, a great example of that is our effort to try to curtail pollution from phosphorus into our lakes. It's an increasingly difficult challenge facing Indiana that you have blue-green algae contamination in virtually every major lake in the state, and it's caused by excess phosphorus runoff, and it's putting a real strain on our recreational economy, and we think there are some cost-effective ways to tackle that problem.
Well, and that's the classic dichotomy that I guess fouls us up is this idea of the economy versus the environment. And lots of people will say that good environmental policy is good economic policy, and that may well be true, but one runs into some sticky points when one deals with something like coal, which in the short term at least is cheaper. How do you cross what seems like a divide between economy and environment?
I think it depends a lot on the way in which we structure public policy. You know, coal prices are going to be increasing because of global demand for coal. And coal-powered electricity will also go up as states comply with environmental legislation that was signed into law by Republicans and embraced by both Republicans and Democrats. So the trend in terms of coal is that coal-based electricity prices are increasing. In our state, which is certainly culturally conservative, it makes sense to pursue a policy of diversification, because diversification will mean, by definition, that we'll not be putting all of our eggs into one basket. And that will be better in terms of mitigating electricity rate increases over time, the more diverse we are.
And to that end, there were some voluntary clean electricity standards that passed in 2011 for the utilities in Indiana, but that's voluntary still. How much difference does something like that make?
Unfortunately, the way the law is structured, it's to be candid, meaningless. And, you know, it's not meant to be a provocative statement there. The fact of the matter is 2 years after the adoption of that legislation, almost 2 years since the adoption of that legislation, there are no investor-owned utilities, including Vectren, that have opted to participate in the voluntary clean electricity program, which, for the benefit of your audience, would be that by 2025, 10% of our electricity will come from clean energy. And the problem with that legislation is there's a number of different problems, actually, with this legislation, one of which is that what constitutes clean energy is extraordinarily broad and exceeds the classical scientific definition of renewable energy.
So,
secondly, the goal is very, very unambitious. You know, we have Illinois and Ohio both aspiring to 25% by 2025, and they're both required policies rather than voluntary policies.
And this gets at a statistic that's on your website, that Indiana is the 49th greenest state in the country. First of all, let me ask, how much does that matter? I mean, we've got 50 states, so someone's going to be 49th, and if standards are going up overall, aren't things just generally getting better? We're not in the 70s anymore. We don't have rivers on fire.
You're absolutely right, Micah, that our environmental quality in general has improved in terms of, you know, your classic air pollutants like sulfur dioxide, nitrous oxide, mercury, particulates, and then certain types of water pollutants like PCBs. There definitely have been areas of progress, and we want to make sure that we acknowledge the great progress has been made. The challenge is that there are certain parts of our state which face really concentrated pollution. And as you well know, Southwest Indiana is one of those parts of the state which has a very high concentration of air and water toxins. And so I think one of the things that we need to do as we are well into the 21st century is say we can't leave certain parts of our American family behind. You know, while most of the population may be benefiting from environmental gains, some parts of our world are, some parts of America are really hurting. And you could even go at a more granular level and think about the fact that there are some poorly operating hog and dairy and chicken operations, that mega operations that are going to be polluting the air and polluting the water because of open air manure lagoons and because of discharges into our streams and into our groundwater. And those are the kinds of things that, again, would be very concentrated in nature and hurt a small but concentrated number of people. And so that's kind of the next frontier in terms of our efforts to protect the environment. We can't leave certain Americans behind in benefiting from clean air and clean water.
When you talk about runoff from farms, for instance, you're talking about things on a pretty granular level. Is that how we tackle the big issues, is by dealing with this community's problem here and that community's problem there?
Well, I think our general outlook is that you've got to have good quality public policy. And the reason is twofold. One is, if we were to operate on a unit-by-unit basis, a group like ours couldn't handle it. We're a pretty lean operation in the whole scheme of things. So it's just about impact. That's partly the rationale for focusing our energies on public policy versus facility-by-facility change. The other piece of it is about creating a level playing field. We want to make sure that the companies that operate in Indiana are subject to the same environmental laws and are subject to the same levels of enforcement should they not be good stewards of the environment. And by doing that, no one feels discriminated. Everyone feels subject to the same treatment by government.
We're talking with Jesse Carbonda. He's the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. That group's Greening of the Statehouse event is on Saturday. We'll have more after a break. This is The Trend.
You're listening to The Trend on 88.3 WNIN and online at WNIN.org. Still ahead in the program, Justin Williams is back with a holiday tablet buying guide on Tech Talk, and we're going to take a look behind the ads, hype, and punditry to find out just how political campaigns get out the vote. That's trending today on WNIN.
Support for WNIN comes from Evansville Day School, preparing for college, preparing for life for over 60 years. Information online at evansvilledayschool.org.
This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Our guest is Jesse Carbonda. He's the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. And you've got your Greening of the Statehouse event tomorrow as we head into the 2013 legislative session in January. We just had an election. We've got some new lawmakers in, a Republican supermajority in both houses of the legislature, a Republican governor on the way in. How would you characterize the incoming legislature?
Well, I think on the face of it, it looks like it's going to be very challenging and very daunting. But what we want to do is break kind of stereotypes. And I think that there's this notion of trust building that needs to happen on both sides, both in our overcoming what perceptions they may have of us and our overcoming any perceptions we may have of them. And again, get into the nitty-gritty nuts and bolts about the fact of the matter is that our public policy priorities are ones that we believe will bring more jobs to the state, increase investment in the state, and at the same time improve indicators of environmental quality. And I think we've just got to patiently work on finding people who recognize that we are pragmatic, that we're very interested in making progress, that we're not intending to slam legislators or necessarily pursue a combative approach, but rather problem solve for the good of the state.
This is a budget year. Does that change your approach or the types of things you're looking for or the types of things you're talking about?
Certainly. Because it's a budget year, we're going to be carefully monitoring several different agencies and programs that have real implications on the environment. Above all, we will certainly want to make sure that the general fund allocation to IDEM and to DNR, the Indiana Department of Environmental Management and the Department of Natural Resources, that those funding levels are constant. It's so important for the economic integrity and growth of the state that we have a robust environmental protection program. You think about the fact that cities like Evansville will have a lot of brownfields, and what IDEM does is provide important technical service to help convert those brownfields into commercially attractive properties, along with obviously private investors, such that you can create a more robust place for investment. And you think about the way in which having an adequate number of inspectors is necessary to make sure that you are avoiding leaking underground storage tanks, which, if they were to happen, could damage or threaten drinking water, and that, of course, would make a community very unattractive for economic development. So we want to hone in on the fact that having a healthy level of funding for these key agencies is critical for the jobs environment of the state.
And on your website, again, looking there, you have a number of headings in terms of areas of concern. And we've talked a little bit about renewable energy and that voluntary standard that passed a year ago. What are you looking for this in this upcoming session in terms of renewable energy legislation?
Well, we'd like to study to see if there are opportunities to amend the bill that you and I have been talking about, this voluntary clean electricity standard. Again, as it's written, it's really not incentivizing the utilities to make investments in renewables. And there are a number of different challenges with it. One of it is that the definition is so broad. So the likelihood that investments will be made in wind or solar or geothermal are minimized just by the virtual broad latitude of the definition. The second is that there's no wiggle room in the possibility that if a utility were to make an investment in renewables and it could have a slight impact on electricity rates, maybe just 1%, the statute as we interpret it would not allow for such an investment. And it's not that we're not sensitive to energy bills. Of course, people are wanting to protect their pocketbooks. But the question is, does it make sense for Indiana, from a long-term perspective, to put all of its eggs in one type of energy resource? We think that's not sound. The other thing is that the more concentrated investment we can make in renewable energy in Indiana, the more likely we can have a magnet for bringing in the component suppliers that help to build those renewable energy power plants. So, for example, if we were to one day have a big solar farm in Evansville of a multi-megawatt scale, thanks to a robust and functioning voluntary clean electricity standard, there is a higher probability that a component manufacturer that maybe provides the silicon or that provides inverters for those solar panels gets drawn into the Evansville market for investment. We've seen that happen in other states that have really high-quality public policy environments.
But doesn't this get back into that sticky issue of the interaction between environmental policy and economics? In that what makes sense over the long term and what might be cheaper over the long term still brings up short-term cost. And so if we're talking about energy production getting more expensive over the long term and trying to mitigate that in the short term by adding in new types of energy, which also in the short term raise costs, are we in a place, are we financially stable enough? Is our economy robust enough to be playing around with energy costs right now?
Yes, that's a very valid question. And, you know, one of the specific things that we've done to strike the right balance between the economy and the environment on something like a voluntary clean electricity standard is let's set a cap above which electricity rates do not rise if we have a meaningful voluntary clean electricity standard. So, for example, what if we allowed the utilities to take advantage of this program and capped the electricity rates at 2% compared to what they currently are? Then what you do is it sends the right signals to the utilities to make those investments in wind and solar and geothermal, while at the same time making sure that those costs are not hurting ratepayers.
So it makes it becomes incremental
then. Policy design.
So it becomes incremental at that point.
It becomes incremental. Right, exactly. And I think the other thing that lawmakers need to do a better job on, and even groups like ours, is that we could look at this wholly from an economic lens or an environmental lens, or we could also look at it from a health lens. Wouldn't Evansville be a more attractive place to live if there were zero polluting energy resources there. And that's why if we had a better voluntary clean electricity standard, it could incent Vectren to invest in a commercial scale solar farm such that you could pull a coal plant offline or reduce its level of operation and therefore have immediate impacts on air quality. And we can't discount the importance of good environmental protection to good public health. It's something that epidemiologists and environmental scientists are continuing to recognize to be an important link between good environmental protection and good public health.
We've been talking about some pretty weighty and challenging issues. Where do you think, where is there an opportunity for maybe not a quick fix, but, you know, a quick fix in terms of environmental policy?
We hope that we can win Republican and Democratic support for a bill that would reduce phosphorus in our lakes and streams. This is a huge problem, as I alluded to earlier in the conversation. You've got a real strain on our $9 billion recreational industry because of this contamination of our lakes from blue-green algae. It's our understanding that as much as 65% of recreation in Indiana is attributed to recreation on water bodies. So there's this very, very concrete monetary adverse impact by our inability to tackle this phosphorus problem. And what we want to do is try to involve retail stores in the effort to tackle this issue. It turns out that Purdue University has concluded that as much as 87% of the residential lawns in Indiana have sufficient phosphorus, and therefore there doesn't need to be additional phosphorus added to people's lawns to make them green, except at the startup of a lawn. And so the thing to do is to partner with these retail stores, ask them to install signs that make people aware of that fact and make people aware that there is an affordable alternative to phosphorus-containing lawn fertilizer, and we will see measurable reductions in phosphorus entering our lakes, and that helps our drinking water, and that helps our recreational economy.
Well, I'm sure we'll hear more from you as the legislative session gets underway and you work on some of these issues and engage in relationships with the new lawmakers who are heading to Indianapolis in January. Tomorrow is the Hoosier Environmental Council's greening of the State House. That's on Saturday in Indianapolis. We've been talking with Jesse Carbonda. He's the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. And thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Michael.
You're listening to The Trend. It's time now for Tony Voss to join us for the B segment.
This week, tech expert Justin Williams is back for our yearly holiday Tech Talk Buyer's Guide. And this time, Justin has a look at the hot item for the year, tablets.
So I think for the past couple of years, you and I have talked about tablets and it being the quote-unquote year of the tablet. And each year, I think tablets have sold relatively well at Christmas, but I also think there's kind of been this subset of our listeners that are like, shut up, Tony and Justin. Those things are like $500. I like my relatives a lot, but I don't like them $500 much. And the thing this year is like tablets have gotten smaller and they've gotten cheaper. And there's now actual legitimate competition out there beyond just an iPad and a lot of iPad wannabes. And the big thing this year seems to be not necessarily the 9 or 10-inch tablets like we've had before with the iPad. It's the new smaller 7-inch tablets.
And that specifically is where iPad has gone with the iPad mini.
iPad mini was released around mid-October of this year. And whereas the original iPad is a 9.7 inches, the new iPad mini is 7.9 inches, conveniently enough. And in addition to like the smaller physical size of it, it's also a couple hundred bucks cheaper at just $329 for the low-end 16 gig model. And what's nice about the 7.9 inch iPad or the iPad mini is this is what feels like quote unquote the real iPad to me. It feels like when you hold this one in your hand, it's like so light and it's so just kind of thin. It feels like it's designed for reading books. It's designed for doing all of those iPad-y things that the big iPad is great, and I use mine all the time still, but at the same time, it's like if you're reading a book on it, it's like, well, this thing is kind of heavy after a while. That's why I always enjoyed using something like a Kindle. So having a smaller iPad that is able to just kind of like throw it in your bag and not really worry about it because it is a little bit cheaper. It's also a little bit lighter. This feels like the iPad that's going to sell far above and beyond what the original did. A lot like what the iPod mini did after the original iPod Classic came out.
that's what Apple's doing. Their main competitor in the tablet field is, of course, Google's Android platform. What have they got for us?
I think we talked about some of the Honeycomb tablets a couple of years ago, and those were, they were there. That's about it.
That happened.
Those happened, yeah. And what happened this summer, though, is they came out with their own tablet called the Nexus 7, and it was kind of the first of the 7-inch tablets that really sold me on that form factor. I picked up a Nexus 7 for $200, and it's running stock Android, like the exact experience that Google wants you to experience. It doesn't have like the HTC or the LG themes on top of it. It's like a pure Android device. And one, it was the first one to sell me on the 7-inch tablet size. But two, it also showed me that Android as a platform had amazingly matured compared to where it was a couple of years ago in terms of like the polish to it, the app experience in the Google apps itself, and just kind of the breadth of what you can do with it. Like, people will knock like the iPad and the iPod for being kind of like watered down and like the things that you can't do with it, especially kind of like super nerds. That is true, especially compared to Android. There are a variety of things that you can do on there in terms of like widgets and like changing out the keyboard, all the kinds of like super nerdy things. But in terms of like the form factor and what you can do with the Android tablet itself compared to the iPad mini, there's not too much of a difference. It kind of just depends whether you like to drink Pepsi or whether you like to drink Coke. They both kind of accomplish the same thing. They're sodas. It's just which flavor do you prefer?
Last year saw the release of the Kindle Fire, and a lot of noise was made about that. I personally saw a lot of people running out to get them ahead of the Christmas season. You know, I haven't heard a whole lot about them.
So Amazon did come out with a new Kindle Fire. There's the Kindle Fire 2, and then there's the Kindle Fire HD. One is the same size as kind of like the 7-inch tablet. And then there's one that's around the size of an iPad. And I think they're still selling relatively well. Amazon doesn't release those figures. They just say it's the best-selling Amazon thing that's ever sold on Amazon ever, but you don't really know what that means. But I think what Amazon's going to run into is, like, you can get this device that has this custom version of Android tailored specifically to the Amazon experience, or you can spend a little bit more money and get an iPad mini, or you can spend about the same money as a Kindle Fire and get a Nexus 7, which is pure Android from Google, and still run the Kindle app and all these other things as well. I think they're going to have a hard time kind of selling that to consumers. I'm still not a big fan of the Kindle Fire. I've used one a little bit, but the Kindle devices itself, if I was going to buy a Kindle device this Christmas, I would buy the Kindle Paperwhite, which is basically the new version of their e-reader that has a frontlit display on it.
And finally, Microsoft has been trying to wedge their way into the tablet world in some way for quite some time and has not had a whole lot of luck doing so. But they really think Windows 8 is going to be their way of smashing that glass ceiling.
If you remember back to the days of like Windows 2000 and Windows XP, Microsoft was the first one with tablets. Like, Windows Tablet Edition was kind of the original, but compared to things like the iPad and like the Nexus 7 or the Nexus 10, that really didn't stack up to it. So Windows 8 is unique in that Windows 8 is for everything. It's for your desktop, it's for your laptop, it's for your phone, and it's for your tablet. It's the same kind of core OS. And the big one that they're touting this Christmas season is the Microsoft Surface, which is the first Microsoft-made piece of hardware out there ever. Like, traditionally, they've always just partnered with like the Dells and the HPs, and they would sell them the software itself, and those guys would make the hardware and just put Windows on it. Now Microsoft is also getting into the kind of build the hardware and the software all into a complete package.
They've been really trying to push integration as well with using the Surface to control things on the Xbox 360. They are really going feet first into this one. This is not another one of those we'll throw a tablet out there and see what happens kind of things.
Right. Microsoft's big thing the past couple of years has been three screens in a cloud. And so you've got your phone, you've got your tablet, you've got your laptop, and then you've got your SkyDrive cloud. And then those are able to control every single aspect of your life. And especially if you're an Xbox user, it'll tie into your Xbox gamer tag. If you use Office, you can use that on any of those devices. And they should all seamlessly sync up. So Microsoft seems to be really ahead in terms of like having everything kind of like converge together and having an offering for every aspect of those platforms. Google, I would say, would be second place in that, or maybe a toss-up between those two, because Google has such amazing cloud services. Apple, I think, is lagging behind in terms of, like, I think they have the best hardware, obviously, just in terms of, like, build. I think iOS is a great platform in terms of, like, the software, and the third-party ecosystem is far and above better than the other two. But in terms of, like, converging them all together, I don't think it's nearly as good as, like, say, sharing documents between Office on your PC and your tablet, or using Google Docs on your Android tablet and then your desktop. I think iCloud has a ways to go in those ways.
On Christmas Day, did I let you down?
Justin Williams is our on-again, off-again tech expert at WNIN, and he also writes a weekly column on technology for the Evansville Courier and Press. Thanks, Micah.
Thanks, Tony. This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. For months, the airwaves were blanketed with political ads telling us whom to vote for or against. In between the ads, we heard punditry and the latest polls. We read about gaffes, stumbles, and comebacks. But that's the show, the entertainment side of the election process. Today, we're talking about the less glamorous side of things, fieldwork and backroom strategy. Our guest is Evansville attorney Josh Claiborne. He's a former officer in the Vandenberg County Republican Party and an organizer of several campaigns. Josh, welcome to The Trend.
Thank you, Micah.
So you were involved, one of the campaigns you were involved with was back in 2008 with the first campaign for Congressman Larry Bouchon, and you were actually involved in recruiting him. How does that work? How does finding someone who's never been in politics before and luring them into the process work?
Well, recruiting candidates is one of the toughest parts of the behind-the-scenes thing. Certainly when you're in a demographic area where it's pretty lopsided from one party to the other, it's somewhat easy. You know, people, strong candidates want to be there. It's easy to be elected. But in a race like the 8th Congressional District, which is known as the Bloody Eighth, it's difficult to get good candidates a lot of times. And that was particularly a good example of that, because at the time when we were trying to recruit a candidate, Barack Obama's polls were off the charts. Brad Ellsworth was in office right then, and at that time he was an incredibly popular candidate. So it was a tough time to draw candidates.
And that was before the Evan Bay upset, where all the dominoes fell
right
on the Democratic
That's
side,
right,
and everybody got reshuffled. And then that ultimately probably opened things up a bit for you.
Right. And for better or worse, you know, Obamacare had really changed the landscape of this area. Nationally, depending on where you are, it's popular or unpopular. Here in Evansville and southwestern Indiana, that, I think, had a negative effect for the Democrat Party. But before that happened, I mean, as the Republican Party, it was very difficult to think, who can we find that's a credible candidate to really be willing to run?
And you were getting involved right at the beginning. I mean, obviously, he was just being considered as a candidate. Are you picking a candidate who can win the primary or a candidate who can win the general?
Well, both, obviously, is what you're looking for. It's tough because you want somebody who can raise money, who can be appealing to the average voter. And in that particular case, we were concerned that we would be able to raise money. We thought people would see it as an unwinnable race. And so that's a good example where sometimes you have to get people who have the pocketbooks. And in Larry's case, you know, he was a very successful physician. And to the extent he needed to, he could finance his own campaign. And sometimes when you're recruiting candidates, that becomes a very important factor.
So he had to jumpstart things.
Right. And eventually, of course, as things got more competitive and the polls started to reflect that, he was able to get more outside donations. But at least from the out of the get-go, he needed that ability to self-start his own campaign.
And that was, of course, when the Tea Party was beginning to rise to its position of prominence. And he had a big primary field to get through and a mm-hmm. Tea Party challenger who had a strong grassroots campaign. And so right. You had this the establishment candidate that the party liked, and then you had the grassroots outsider battling, and they came within a few, you know, not a lot of votes separating them in the primary.
Right, and you know, when you're, regardless of whether you're Republican or Democrat, when you're recruiting a candidate, you want somebody who can really unite both of those, you know, the activist base and the business interests and kind of the more establishment parts of the party. That's a very challenging thing to do, and obviously when you find somebody who has all of those elements and can appeal to everybody, you grab a hold of him. You know, I think Larry, in his particular case, now he's starting to, I think, get a lot of the support from the grassroots. But certainly at the time, he struggled with that. And, you know, as a party official, as I was at the time, you really have to weigh those things of their ability to finance, their ability to reach out to business interests, their ability to relate to the, you know, to the activists and all those different groups. And it's a challenge.
So is voter appeal ultimately the thing that's the make or break, or is it stuff like fundraising?
Well, it's certainly voter appeal, but to appeal to voters, you have to be able to get your message out, right? And fundraising is undoubtedly a huge part of that. Obviously, the ability to work with media is important. The ability to craft a message that appeals to the general public, that the media is going to be willing to report on, those are important things. But you know, at the end of the day, if you can buy a 30-second radio ad or send two mailers to somebody's homes, that goes quite a long way.
Do those ads make a difference?
They do. And it really depends on the race, though, whether that becomes a factor. I mean, when you're running for county council or county commissioner, you're not going to be on TV. And for that matter, you might not even be able to be on the radio. You're really banking on stuff like yard signs, maybe a mailer, and the church picnics.
And sort of door-to-door work, right?
Sure, certainly.
Because you're working with a much more manageable number of voters in a smaller area.
Right.
But you have something like the 8th Congressional District, which you can drive for hours and still be in the 8th Congressional District.
Yeah.
And you've got this rural contingency, and then you have some cities. Mm-hmm. So I guess ad buys in that kind of a campaign do matter.
They do. You know, and people really decry the influence of money in politics. I certainly understand it. But at the end of the day, you have to reach voters. And in this type of an environment with media nowadays, it's so crowded in terms of information. As you pointed out, in races like the 8th District, there is so many media, small media markets to go into. And frankly, people are so busy that they don't pay attention to the media as much. At the end of the day, you really have to spend money to get in front of them and get their attention.
Both in person and on the air.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you've got your candidate, you have some money in the bank now, and now you put together the people who run this team. And I know you were one of the people who you headed up that early portion of Larry Bouchon's first congressional campaign. Who else did you have working with you?
Well, he was much like most candidates and that are running for Congress or even mayor or something like that. And it's typically a lot of younger college-age people who have the passion, the energy, and the time. I think along with that, a lot of times retired folks also have time. They also have a strong interest in politics. You see that reflected when you look at who goes out to the polls. And so really, the activists within a campaign are those very divergent age groups, the retired older people and the younger college or just out of college-age people.
You don't have the 30-somethings who have young kids at home.
No, they're more rare on the campaign trail in terms of activists.
Yeah.
But, you know, they do vote. It's somebody you want to reach. But in terms of building a campaign team, you focus more on those other two groups.
And in my role in the media, going to campaign rallies and talking with candidates and so forth, there seems to be this archetype that's there. And it's the young 20-something, usually guy, in his crisp-looking shirt, and he's the campaign manager. He's the guy taking the business cards and the gatekeeper. Who are these guys? They're usually not from where the candidate's from.
Well, yeah, of course, you know, in a race like county commissioner or mayor, that they're going to be from the community. But for a congressional campaign, a lot of times the national party will send a couple people, and I think you've done a good job of describing what they're like a lot of times. But also from a state level, you know, there's people in Indianapolis or Northeast Indiana that want to get involved in a congressional race, and maybe the 8th District is the best way they can do that. And so the state party or a fellow congressman will recommend people a lot of times as well.
You also had a consultant involved in that. There were a few people who were actual staff for the Bouchon campaign, then you had a consultant involved as well.
That's right. Again, in those races where you have the money to do it, you'll often bring in somebody who has connections and the ability to really reach out to pollsters and analyze polling data, reach out to advertising type folks, and be able to craft a good message and for that matter, a good TV spot, good 30-second ad, a good platform to run on. You know, these are people who have been around the block a lot of times. They've run and been a part of a lot of other campaigns, and so they have a general sense of what works and what doesn't. Of course, you have to then tailor that to the particular area. And the 8th District is, you know, like all districts, unique in its own ways.
I do want to ask you about polling, because polling in and of itself was huge news with this presidential campaign that just passed. And what role do polls play, and the external polls versus the internal polls?
You know, the campaigns I've been a part of, they've been huge, just absolutely huge, because from the get-go, they can decide whether a candidate has a chance or not, in that case, whether they'll run. Then once they're in, they can help decide the message. You know, the candidate, I like to say, what they're run on, what they believe in, what they believe in doesn't change. But maybe of the platform of things they believe in, what they emphasize is often influenced by the polls or how they package and message and, you know, deliver that belief that they have. And then polling is also quite big in fundraising. When you go to somebody and you say, hey, I want you to donate $5,000, $10,000, they're going to ask, well, what are the polls show? Because obviously they don't want to invest that kind of money in a losing campaign.
We're talking with Republican political activist Josh Claiborne. More after a break. You're listening to The Trend on WNIN.
I'm Tony Voss, and you're listening to The Trend on 88.3 WNIN FM and WNIN.org. Support for WNIN comes through a grant from the Charles and Jan Stimftonoggle family, who encourage your support of public broadcasting.
You're listening to The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Our guest is GOP political activist and local attorney Josh Claiborne. And Josh, you were talking about polls and fundraising and ad buys. What about databases and really knowing who the voters are and who these elusive but much courted swing voters are?
Yeah, that's incredibly important. And both of the two main parties here in Indiana, the Republican Party and the Democrat Party, have invested a lot of money in central databases. And when you're a local candidate or congressional candidate for either party, you get to tap into and use that database. And it's amazing what that database has identified. You know, your voting history, your preferences, often whether, for instance, your main issues are abortion or gun control or whatever it might be, so that they know how they can best reach you. And a lot of times they'll tailor the mail pieces specific based on that information they have. And everyone relies on it so much, and I know that the national campaigns have really started to develop those same type of databases and often use the state databases. But at least here in Indiana, whether you're running a campaign in Evansville, Vandenberg County, or the 8th District, you're going to reach out to and use your state party to use their database.
Where does that information come from?
Well, your voting history is public record, and so you can go to the county clerk and look. And by voting history, obviously, I don't mean who you voted for in the race, but rather what party you went to vote for in the primary. And that tells whether you're typically going to be more Republican or Democrat. Also, how often you voted. So in the last 4 years or four elections, did you vote in 1, 2, 3, or all four of those? So, and then also more recently, another big item that has is whether you're an early voter. And so all of those are very important when you're tailoring your messaging, your ads. When you go door to door, for instance, you'll have these lists printed out to know what doors to knock on.
You've also worked on the Lloyd Winicky campaign, the Evansville mayor, the mayoral race in 2011.
Right.
And what's different about that kind of a race versus working on this bigger congressional race?
Well, it's interesting because the mayoral race really has a way of dominating the landscape, because in 2011, there was no other real races. I mean, that was a year, an off year. So it really did dominate the local media. And that often makes things easier, because when you issue a policy paper or something happens at all within the race, the local media is going to be interested in it and covering it. Maybe counterintuitive to what you might think, in a congressional race, a lot of times that kind of stuff can come and go and nobody really pays attention. So that was an interesting race just for how high profile it was. But it was also neat in that because it is a smaller area, you can really reach so many of the voters who are going to be voting. I mean, the actual amount of voters who vote in an Evansville election is relatively small. And so, again, going back to those databases, you can start to target both with phone calls and door-to-door quite specific people you know are going to vote and also people you know are likely to want to support you.
Talk a bit about door-to-door, because it seems that face-to-face contact, just the way we're wired as humans, talking to another human being is more likely to influence our behavior than watching an ad or getting something in the mail.
Yeah, it is important, I think. You know, it's interesting, though, because there have been some judicial candidates recently who made an effort to knock on every door they could. And we heard stories about how they went through four or five pair of shoes because they were walking down streets so much. But at the end of the day, the judicial candidate I'm referring to actually ended up losing. And so sometimes you look at what other people really focus on and see whether it works or not, and you start to wonder, well, is that really effective? But I do think at the end of the day, door-to-door does work. I mean, it does register with people. It does stick out in their head, and it does feel like they're really being paid attention to.
Give me a sense of a day in the life of a campaign, just a normal run-of-the-mill, you know, Wednesday during a campaign.
For a candidate, it's just nonstop. You know, from the minute you wake up to the minute you go to bed, you are at every event you can think of. I mean, you look at the calendar of community events and you say, where are the most people or most likely voters going to be? I need to be there. And so if you're helping out with a campaign, you have to go there as well to help assist. Sometimes it's writing, you know, getting people to write letters to the editor, it's making calls, it's doing all of those things, but it really is a nonstop grind when you're part of it.
And what about for the staffers?
Yeah, I mean, and for the staffers, it's often the same way. I mean, some of them will be with the candidates to help. I mean, when you're as a candidate out, people are always coming up to you with thoughts, needs, questions, and so you need staffers on hand to help assist with that or to help pass out the material or whatever it may be. So always staffers at some point are kind of stuck to the hip of the candidate. But at the same time, there's the staffers that are behind doing some of the grunt work that, you know, the candidate gets to be out in front smiling, shaking hands while the staffer is making sure the phones are working, making sure that the volunteers are there for the following day's door-to-door event or whatever it may be.
And I wonder, it seems that people who go through, I say this a little bit facetiously, but people who go through traumatic events in life find a kinship with others who have had that experience. I imagine for people who have worked on a campaign and been through that grind and just that grueling, nonstop, probably high adrenaline often experience, must feel that most people don't know what that's like. And so you must have an affinity to other people who have experienced that.
I think that's very true. I mean, you know, here in Indiana, in Southwest Indiana, a lot of the politicos, as we like to call them, people who are quite involved in the political process, are very good friends, you know, when they're on the opposite sides of the aisle. You know, we look nationally, there's a great example of that in Mary Madeline and James Carville, who were high-profile strategists during the 1992 presidential campaign, ended up getting married. I think even here locally, we see a lot of people that are very, very good friends that are operatives on either side because of it. It's a lot of fun.
So the acrimony and the fights that one sees and the negative advertising and all that stuff that makes it seem like candidates must hate each other, and you would assume that carries over to the staffers as well. Is that true or is that show?
You know, sometimes it's true, but I think a lot of times the staffers have an easier ability to get along. You know, I think candidates that run in a race, it is often difficult for them to be friends afterwards. It's not totally rare, but it is more rare. However, the staffers often can still get along, can still relate, particularly when they're not running against each other. You know, so if a staffer is running a race for a congressional campaign, they might be able to relate for the staffer for the governor's campaign and, you know, share war stories and the like.
What do you do when the campaign's over?
Usually get a very big beer at the closest tavern you can find. Kind of reassess what happened, what did you do right, what did you do wrong, and analyze a lot of the voting stuff as well to make sure you can see, well, we did this media strategy or this door-to-door strategy, whatever it may be in this area, and it worked or it didn't. And that way you have that knowledge for the next campaign.
Now, the two campaigns we talked about, the first Larry Bouchon congressional campaign and the Lloyd Winnicke mayoral campaign, both were winning campaigns, but you were also involved in the Yes for Consolidation campaign. Now, you don't have a candidate there. That's a referendum, so a little different. But you were on the losing side there. Big difference day after?
Certainly. I mean, it's less festive. But to go back to polling that we talked about earlier, that was a race where we did polling early on and we were down. And as we did polling throughout, we did quite a bit of polling throughout that, we knew we did not have a good chance of winning. So that kind of helps soften the blow when you have a good idea of what the result is going to be. You know, in that particular race, I think we were able to move the dial in terms of what we started out at. But yeah, that's a you know, not a result you want. You look for the positives. You know, what came of this? Were we able to get some message across, help move some people, convince some people? And, you know, whether you're a candidate or, in this case, a referendum, hope that maybe whatever it is you're trying to push or advocate can have another life, another day.
What keeps you coming back to this? You've been involved in politics now for some years.
Yeah, you know, I think I care about the future of our community, our state, and our nation, just like everybody else. You know, I really want to, when I see that it's the people that are elected that really have such a big influence on that. And so I want to make sure that that moves in a positive direction. I want to make sure that it's quality people that are getting in office too. And then when we find quality people, that we can help get them elected.
A lot of people are cynical about the political process. Is that well-founded?
Well, I guess it depends on the issue that makes them what they're cynical about, whether that's money or what they see as poor quality candidates. But, you know, my response to that is not to step away and become disengaged, but rather to become even more engaged and make sure that you get the kind of quality candidates or you're pushing the type of issues that you do think are important. And so I would challenge people that say or have a cynical view about this kind of stuff to take that as a reason to get even more involved. And that's certainly what I've done.
Josh Claiborne is a former officer in the Vandenberg County Republican Party. He's a political activist and local attorney. Josh, thanks so much for this behind-the-scenes tour.
Thank you, Micah.
You are listening to The Trend on WNIN-FM and WNIN.org. I'm Tony Voss.
Support for WNIN comes from Morton Solar, a renewable energy solution provider for residential, commercial, governmental, and utility clients. Located in Evansville, Indiana, Morton Solar provides consultation, engineering and design, and installation for projects throughout the tri-state area. Learn more at mortonsolar.com or 812-402-0900.
Okay, normally we'd have the Arts Notebook here, but we're out of time. Roger McBain will be back in the studio next week, promise. And on next week's show, we'll get into the holiday spirit by asking, what happens to all the wrapping paper and packaging we throw out? Trash beyond the curb, plus conversation and music with a classical guitarist. To get in touch with The Trend, click on The Trend at WNIN.org, and you'll find links for Facebook, Twitter, and email. Weekly podcasts are there and at CourierPress.com. Plus, we're on iTunes and in the NPR podcast directory. The Trend is a production of WNIN in collaboration with the Evansville Courier and Press. Ryan Reynolds is our producer at the Courier and Press. Tony Voss is our associate producer. He also engineers the show. Our theme music was written by Jeffrey Osman. I'm Micah Schweitzer. We'll talk again next week. This is WNIN-FM, Evansville, Henderson, and Owensboro.